Well, good afternoon, everybody in the UK, and to those of you listening to Europe, and those of you listening later through the recordings on the Global Teleclass series. My name's Martin Kinnan, and I'm a nurse consultant in infection prevention at Southport or Ormskirk Hospital NHS Trust in the UK. It's my great pleasure to host today's teleclass, which is ventilation in healthcare facilities. Our speaker today is Peter Hoffman. Now, Peter is well known to many of us in the UK and overseas. He's a consultant clinical scientist. He works in the antimicrobial resistance and healthcare infections reference unit of Public Health England at Colindale, where he's worked since I'm told he was a child in the late 1970s. He summarizes his function as being a jobbing scientist in infection prevention and manages to thrive on a variety of issues that this has to offer, everything from helping design a high-security infectious disease isolation unit to advising on Garo Roofer fish pedicures. His backgrounds are in disinfection, sterilization, and specialist ventilation, and he applies his experience both proactively, helping in production of guidance and standards, and reactively in assisting in outbreaks and incidents where he provides advice and helps to investigate, plus a wide variety of general advice. I actually think it's probably fair to say that in the UK we would all consider Peter to be the ultimate phone-a-friend. If you have an environment-related infection prevention issue, you pick up the phone, and he is always very generous with his advice. He teaches in the UK and internationally, is a regular speaker at IFIC international meetings in the developing nations, and runs courses also in developing nations as well. He's an assistant editor on the Journal of Hospital Infection, and he's a member of the UK or Department of Health England Rapid Review Panel, which helps to assess new technology for infection control. In addition to all of this, he's still managed to publish a number of papers and is extensively quoted in guidance. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Peter as we sit back to enjoy ventilation in healthcare facilities. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you very much, Martin. There's a fine line between phoning a friend and scraping a barrel. Now, ventilation is one of those bywaters of infection prevention. It's something that you will not have routine day-to-day contact with, but just occasionally, particularly during emergencies, you might need to know something about. So this aims to give you a background in ventilation as it affects infection prevention. Slide 2, please, Martin. There are lots of ventilation engineers around. Most of them are just used to ventilating premises in order to keep people comfortable, to supply fresh air, to get rid of heat gains from equipment in offices, solar heat gains and so on. There are a few who are used to designing ventilation systems in order to ensure people's safety, getting rid of toxic gases, flammable or explosive gases, or other nuisances such as excess humidity from hydrotherapy pools or smells. There are a very few who are expert in controlling and diluting airborne pathogens, which is what I'm going to concentrate on. So just because you get somebody who is an expert ventilation engineer doesn't necessarily mean you get someone who knows how to apply that to infection prevention. So you are perfectly within your rights to question the engineers, to establish exactly what they're doing in terms of infection prevention, and if you think they've got it wrong, to suggest that they redesign the scheme in order to take your view of infection prevention into account. Slide 3, please. Now, in the UK, we have guidance for specialist ventilation in healthcare contained in a piece of guidance known as Health Technical Memorandum, HTM 0301. This and other UK guidance is available on the website shown at the bottom of the page, www.gov.uk. HTM 0301 has been around since late 2007. It covers both design and validation of specialist systems, specifically operating theatres, and also once they have been brought into operation, how to manage them and verify their performance at future dates. HTM 0301 dates from 2007. It only applies to new installations and major refurbishment of existing installations. Prior to that, there was less detailed guidance, HTM 2025. Now, 2007 is not a specific cut-off date between the two. If a hospital was designed before 2007, but not built until, for example, 2010, it will still have operating theatres that comply to the previous guidance, 2025. Guidance here should be treated as guidance. It's not strictly dictatorial. You can't say that because a theatre is in current use, it should conform to 0301. It really depends when it was designed. Next slide, please. We're being encouraged to be increasingly green within healthcare. Traditionally, hospitals are very high carbon footprint buildings. We're being encouraged to use natural means of ventilation that use far lower resources. Natural ventilation can come in a variety of ways. It could be just opening windows. There are increasingly sophisticated wind-driven and stack ventilation that let hot air rise through the building and replace it with cool air that's brought in at a lower level that are used. So natural ventilation has to be designed in really from the start. It's cheap, it has a low carbon footprint, but in many systems there's a lack of magnitude to a certain extent and direction of airflow in particular. Mechanical ventilation is expensive. It's expensive to install. It's also expensive to maintain. But you do, if it's installed correctly, get control, comfort, and you can control the way that air moves between different areas. So hospitals are increasingly being designed with a mixture of ventilation principles. Natural ventilation, where all you need is comfort, but mechanical ventilation, where you want good control over the way that air moves. Next slide, please. Two types of overall ventilation system to consider. Normal people have balanced ventilation, where X units of air will be supplied to a particular room every hour, and X units of air will be extracted from that room every hour. In healthcare, we have deliberately imbalanced so-called cascade ventilation. There's a deliberate imbalance between supply and extract. So if you supply far more air to a room than you extract, that extra air will have to leak out somewhere. It leaks out through all the many gaps in the fabric of the room. If air is leaking out, it means that no air from outside that hasn't been through the ventilation system can leak back into a room. Similarly, if you extract more air than you supply from a room, the difference between supply and extract is made up by air coming into a room. Nothing that's produced as an airborne pathogen within the room will be able to escape outside. It will all go out via the extract system. That's negative pressure. So it's cascade ventilation that really gives you control over the way that air moves between rooms. The way that we can control quality of the air is to filter it. Now, the health sector is far too small a player in the air filter market to dictate its own standards. So we use standards that suit other people. Most filters are used to protect decor, to stop dust and carbon soot particles from coming into buildings. So the general range of filters are specified by what proportion of various standard size dusts they will retain. They can't tell you anything about retention of particles of a certain size at a certain percentage. Next slide, please. Then we come on to HEPA filters. HEPA, HE, high efficiency, P, particulate, air, and A for air filters. These are very fine filters. They're finer than anything we really need. They're tested against their most penetrating particle size, which generally turns out to be about 0.3 to 0.4 of a micron. This is much smaller than anything we're interested in. Fungal spores weigh in at about 3.5 microns in diameter. So they're finer than anything we need. They're really designed for the microelectronics industry. But if you're serious about filtration, you resort to HEPA filters. ULPA filters are way beyond anything that we need. Next slide, please. You may well be familiar with these things on various flat roofs in hospitals. This is the air handling unit. This is the basic unit that controls airflow within mechanically ventilated systems. Next slide, please. Let's take a look at the inside of it. On the left-hand side of the diagram is fresh air intake. It's good if the air handling unit can get fresh air, is not near, say, a car park where diesel lorries are revving up. It then comes in through in temperate climate, it comes in through a FOST coil, which is a heating element which is designed just to put a little bit of heat into air on days when the air is just slightly above zero, so the pre-filter doesn't ice up. Then there's the pre-filter. This is a fairly cheap, coarse filter. This exists for two reasons. Firstly, in order to take a lot of the particulate challenge on the more expensive final filter away. Secondly, to take out large particles that would end up depositing and insulating heat exchange surfaces later in the air handling unit, the cooling coil and the heating coil. Then you get the fan. The fan is the basic essential of the air handling unit. It pulls air in from outside and then pushes it down the ductwork system. Then you get heat exchange coils, the cooling coil and the heating coil. These are units with fine pipework. Cold water will be circulating through the cooling coil, hot water will be circulating through the heating coil. So these exist to take heat away or add heat to the air. Humidifiers are a bit of an optional extra. In healthcare ventilation, they tend not to be used, and no one seems to notice very much. If you do have humidifiers, they should be steam-generated humidifiers rather than liquid water-supplied humidifiers. Finally, there's the final filter. Then the air goes down a series of branching ducts. An air handling unit can supply quite a number of rooms. It's normal in operating theatres that one air handling unit supplies all the rooms in one operating theatre suite, or, more usually, all the rooms in an adjoining pair of operating theatre suites. Next slide, please. Now, the only point that you need to be aware of with air handling units is that if you really want to control air quality, the filter has to be in place. The final filter has to be in place after the fan. The reason for this is that after the fan pulls air in from outside and then pushes it down the ductwork. Before the fan, the air handling units will be under negative pressure, so any holes in the air handling unit, and there will always be holes and gaps in it, will leak inwards. After the fan, because the fan is pushing air down, all the air handling unit after the fan is under positive pressure, these holes and gaps will leak outwards. If the final filter is before the fan, there's an area of the air handling unit after the final filtration that's under negative pressure, so there'll be ingress of unfiltered air. If the fan is before the final filter, then there will be a slight loss of clean air after the final filter, but no ingress of unfiltered air. If you find high fungal counts in an operating theatre, check that the air handling unit has been constructed properly. Next slide, please. How do you tell if a filter is blocked? There are people who will look at filters and say, yep, that's clean, or nope, that's dirty. They're bluffing. A filter puts a resistance on air passing through it. The more the filter is blocked, the greater resistance will be. So each filter is produced with manufacturer's specifications of what sort of resistance they should put in the air. So you measure the pressure before and after a filter. That's read out as a pressure differential. If the pressure differential is below the manufacturer's specification, it probably means there's either a hole in the filter or a hole around the filter, so air is bypassing without being filtered. If the pressure is too high, is the high side of the manufacturer's specifications, this means the filter is badly blocked. All the little holes and pores that air goes through are blocked, and you're not passing enough air through it. Then the filter needs changing. This will normally be detected on a building management system, so-called BMS, and it will be centrally detected in advance of the filter becoming critically blocked, so the filter change can be planned. Don't sample filters. If you sample a filter and find, for example, Aspergillus spores on it, this means the filter is doing its job. It's removing Aspergillus spores. It would be fairly disastrous if you sampled a filter and didn't find any fungal spores. This would mean it wasn't removing the spores. Finding microbes on a filter doesn't implicate the filter as a source of contamination. Slide 12, please. The main source of contamination in an operating theatre are contaminated skin scales. Skin is constantly budding off from basal layer. The cells will die and dry as they come up through the skin. On the top layer of the skin, there'll be skin scales with microcolonies of bacteria, anything between 1 and 1,000 individual bacterial cells in the microcolony. These will then float off and land slowly under gravity. Slide 13, please. This is something that I set up in my laboratory here at Colindale, which is ventilated in much the same way as a conventionally ventilated operating theatre. This is me setting the sampler up in the operating theatre and sampling 1,000 litres of air, 1 cubic metre, with me standing outside the room. There are 2 colonies. In 1 cubic metre of air. Slide 14, please. This is exactly the same about 3 minutes later, but instead the difference is that I'm walking up and down by the side of the air sampler, so those extra bacterial colonies are generated by me. This is one person. Imagine this now being in an operating theatre with 7 or 8 people in it. So, slide 15, please. So, the main source of contamination in operating theatre is the staff, and the whole purpose of the ventilation is to stop bacteria from settling out in the wound. Now, I've put the wound in inverted commas here because I have a slightly unusual concept of what the wound is. Slide 16, please. Staff will generate contamination according to their number and how much they're moving. Airborne contamination will float through the air. It could land directly in the wound, or it could also land on exposed sterile instruments, which will later, in effect, be sampled in the wound. Probably the majority of airborne bacteria that end up in a wound do so via instruments. So So keeping the instruments clean is at least as important as keeping the wound clean. Next slide, please. So operating theatres, the ventilation exists to dilute contamination generated in the theatre and also to protect the theatre from ingress of airborne contamination from surrounding areas. This is done by supplying a lot of filtered air to those areas in a theatre that you want to be the cleanest, and you then encourage it to flow out to surrounding areas. As it flows out to surrounding areas, it achieves two things. Firstly, it entrains contamination generated and flushes it out, so it dilutes contamination. Secondly, if air is passing from critical areas in the theatre out to surrounding areas, it means that no contaminated air from outside the theatre can pass back up, because air is always already flowing outwards through those gaps. So this is the basis of operating theatre ventilation. Slide 18, please. This is a diagram of conventionally ventilated operating theatre ventilation. Let me take it through you bit by bit. Look at the letters S and the letters E. S is supply ventilation, E is extract ventilation. You'll notice the deliberate imbalance of supply and extract. There are rooms like the prep room and the operating room which only have supply ventilation, rooms like the disposal which only has extract. The only room with balanced ventilation is the anaesthetic room, and that's in order not for infection prevention, but to dilute unexpected releases of anaesthetic gas, so it's for chemical safety. In square boxes is the pressure in pascals relative to absolute. So the prep room has 35 pascals positive to absolute. The operating room has 25 pascals. There's a pressure differential between the prep and the operating room of 10 pascals, with the prep room being at higher pressure. So the cleanest room in an operating theatre suite is not the operating room, but the prep room. Air flows from the prep room into the operating room. It flows from the operating room into all surrounding areas except the prep room. In the circle is the air change rate. More of this later, but in essence, the operating room, for a new operating room on commissioning, 25 times the volume of the operating room is supplied to the is supplied via the ventilation system to the operating room. So this is a factor. This measures the dilution that will happen in the operating room. Next slide, please. This is another sort of operating room. This is an ultra-clean ventilated theatre, UCV theatre, often known as a laminar flow theatre or an orthopaedic theatre. Now, instead of looking at it from above, as in the last example, we're looking at it from the side. If you look at the top left, you'll recognise the air handling unit. Air is supplied to an ultra-clean ventilated theatre in much the same way as it's supplied to a conventionally ventilated theatre, but then it goes to a canopy in the centre of the ceiling of the operating room, where there are extra fans and HEPA filters, and air comes down in straight lines over the operating table and hopefully also over instruments being stored ready to use, exposed instruments. It produces straight line flow down over the central area, which is then recycled back via the fans in the canopy. This system needs a lot of air to run it, more than could be supplied economically by the air handling unit, so it uses locally recycled air. Now, if any contamination is generated under the canopy from people, it's immediately entrained in the downward airflow and very rapidly removed. It goes down to the floor level and then out of the central area. If there are any airborne contaminants in the periphery of the operating theatre, if they come towards the canopy, they're entrained in the outermost downward flow, taken down to floor level and removed. So this produces very clean ventilation in the defined area in center of the theatre, and is normally used for the those surgical procedures that are most sensitive to airborne contamination, typically orthopedic large prosthetic work. Slide 20, please. Operating room ventilation is mainly judged on engineering parameters. You would only do microbiological sampling after all the ventilation parameters, the engineering parameters, have been verified. You would not do it as the sole evaluation, the sole commissioning criterion. You would only do it when everything else has been verified as okay. Slide 21, please. This is more about air changes. So if you've got, in this example, a room of, say, 50 cubic meters, and you supply it with, for example, 50 cubic meters of air, that defines one air change. If you supply it with 50 cubic meters every hour, that defines one air change per hour. If you supply it with four times that much, 200 cubic meters, you'll produce, every hour, you'll produce four air changes per hour. In new operating theatres, there should be at least 25 air changes per hour, and similarly in prep rooms. Now, where HTM 0301 goes into greater detail than HTM, its predecessor, HTM 2025, is in recognizing that machinery decreases in efficiency as it ages. So although you start off at 25 air changes per hour, on commissioning, on subsequent revalidation, it's allowed not more than a 20% drop-off in performance. So this means that the air change rate in an operating theatre and in a prep room should never be below 19 air changes per hour. In addition to this, engineers rather like to measure the differential pressure. They can get rather hung up on values. For our concerns, all we need to know is that air is flowing robustly in the right direction. The pressure with which it does it is of far less interest to us. Slide 22, please. It's recommended that microbiological sampling is carried out in operating theatres as part of a commissioning, an initial validation process. Air in an empty operating theatre should contain, air supplied to an empty operating theatre should contain no more than 10 colony-forming units per cubic metre of air. It was 35 in the 2025 guidance, which sounds like a very precise figure. But if you work it back to pre-decimalization, to old measurements, that equates to one colony-forming unit every cubic foot of air. It wasn't accurate, it was just a ballpark figure. People who do regular sampling in theatres know that if you got anywhere near that, then there was something dubious with the ventilation. So this was shifted down to 10 colony-forming units. There is also guidance that you should have less than 180 colony-forming units in a working operating theatre. Now, the generation of contamination depends on the number of people and the amount of movement they're doing. So, this is not a measurement that should need to be taken. If you go into an operating theatre and see that there are people in there that there shouldn't be, you don't need to sample microbiologically to know that. The other reason why there could be high counts is that people are moving around. You can hardly tell people to move less. It's if they need to move, they will move. So, other than a certain propaganda element, I wouldn't recommend you sample in a working operating theatre. You're generating results that you really don't know what to do with. If you do need to go into an operating theatre and carry out what I think of as propaganda sampling to convince them they're doing something wrong, then my guidance would be to sample either the beginning or the end of a procedure when people are at their most active, rather than in the middle of procedure when things are rather quiet. Slide 23, please. Microbiological sampling in operating theatre can be rather daunting if you haven't done it before. some ground rules to help you. Always pre-incubate your plates. Quite a number of plates are supplied contaminated. This will weed those out. Set the sampler up on a clean surface. It's got to be a clean surface because sampling will kick up any dust below the sampler, which can then be sampled. You will then be sampling surfaces rather than the air. Put the agar plate in, then go out to an area that's at lower pressure. Operate the sampler remotely. Make sure that no one else enters the theatre. Give it about 10 or 15 minutes for the organisms that you dispersed while setting it up to be diluted and flushed out. Then operate the sampler remotely. Most samplers now have remote infrared controls, or you can get samplers that you can pre-program. Wait until the sampler has stopped. Take the plate out. I always take duplicate samples. If you get a strange reading with one sample, it's very reassuring to have it confirmed with a second sample. You only need to take samples in one area of the theatre. It's the same air handling unit supplying the whole of the theatre. You'll get the same air quality throughout the theatre. You don't need to sample in more than one place. Slide 24, please. Now, there's a certain amount of false contamination which you need to be aware of. If other people are doing the sampling, you need to find out their technique and analyze it. Some people believe that they can switch the sampler on and then stand in the operating theater and they're sampling the operating theater air. Not really, they're sampling the operating theater plus what they're adding to it. They really need to set the sampler up in an empty theater and then operate it remotely with a 15-minute gap. If they stand in the preparation room is at positive pressure of the theatre, so what they disperse in the prep room will go into the theatre and they'll end up sampling that, not the air being supplied to the theatre from the ventilation system. Make sure the plates are not contaminated before, that's pre-incubating, or after. Be very careful about handling a plate afterwards. It can get contaminated after it's finished taking the sampling, after the sample. If the air sample is put on a dusty floor and then run, it can kick up dust, which is then contaminated dust, which is then sampled. Also, particularly if it's a new system, there's likely to be dust within the ductwork. The ventilation should be turned on at least 24 hours. You can just about get away with about 3 or 4 hours, ideally 24 hours before you take the sample, in order to blow all that loose dust out of the ventilation system. Next slide, please. Just occasionally you get real contamination in an operating theatre. You need to check the grade of filter that's being used. The grade of filter in a British operating theatre is normally grade F7. We use sub-HEPA filters quite successfully, grade F7 or above. Sometimes either people haven't put enough filters in place, so there are gaps in the filter mounting, or the filter mounting has unfilled gaps around it, which allow air to bypass filtration. You need to check that. It's a matter of looking in the air handling unit. It could be because, as I referred to earlier, the air handling unit has been improperly constructed, so the final filter is before the fan, and you're getting ingress of contaminated air after the final filter. It could be because there's too low an air change rate, which means that what you dispersed when setting the sample up hasn't been efficiently diluted out before you take the sample. Or it could be because of air short-circuiting. So air is supplied, but instead of diluting the whole of the theatre, it short-circuits to an exit point, and most of the air in the theatre is stagnant. Or it could be because of inadvertent, incorrect movement of air between rooms in the theatre suite. Next slide, please. A lot of things get blamed for contaminated air sampling results in theatre that really shouldn't be. Most people will say, the environment wasn't clean. They'll send domestics in to clean the theatre and then take another sample. If you're sampling it properly, you're not sampling contamination on surfaces, you're only sampling the air. So a lot of this reaction is due to poorly taken samples on one occasion affecting the result, but by chance not affecting the result on other occasions. If you have the right technique, you should be able to sample air in a theatre that hasn't had its final clean and it successfully represents the air that's being supplied to that theatre. Dirty ductwork gets quite a lot of blame for contamination, airborne contamination in theatre. Improperly so. Think of the particles in the ductwork as being within two size ranges. There are those particles contaminating ductwork that are small and easily entrained in the ventilation airflow. Those particles will have been entrained and blown out of the ductwork days, weeks, or months beforehand. They won't still be around. There are also particles that are too heavy to be entrained in the airflow. Well, they don't matter. They're not going to contribute to contamination in theatre. Some people sample in ductwork, microbiological sample in ductwork, and say the ductwork is contaminated. It must be contributing to the operating theatre airborne contamination. No, not if it's in samples that are too heavy to be entrained. Contamination in ductwork is in a dry state. It won't replicate. It will just slowly die off with time. There's no point in microbiological sampling of ductwork. People also blame dirty filters. Filters trap contamination. They don't release it. Ironically, filters become more efficient as they block up. Filters will have a range of pore sizes. Most air goes through the larger pores, so most particles go through the larger pores. The larger pores will block up before the smaller pores. Filters become more effective at filtering as they block up. They just become less efficient at passing air. So dirty filters will result in inadequate air supply. They won't result in airborne contamination. Next slide, please. UltraClean theatre don't require microbiological sampling. It's far too coarse a measure. UltraClean theatres are sampling validated by demonstration of adequate air velocities under the canopy, such that the air is flowing down robustly and can resist the upward thermals from people and operating theatre lights. It's validated by ensuring that all the HEPA filters are in place such that air can't bypass them or go through holes in them, and that the airflow under the canopy is able to resist ingress of contamination from the theatre periphery. Slide 28, please. So when an ultra-clean theatre is set up, somebody will mark out the floor under it in a 10 by 10 grid, and in each of those 10 by 10 squares, they will measure the downward air velocity at a height of 2 metres. The average of that should not be below 0.38 metres per second. And at 1 metre, in the centre 36 squares, they will measure the velocity and it should be no less than 0.2 metres per second. It's these latter readings that are more important. All the action is at 1 metre high. The instruments are at 1 metre high and the wound is at 1 metre high. So those are the important readings. Next slide, please. Do you need to air operating theatres after a dirty or infected case? Not really. Dilution in operating theatres is very rapid. Any airborne contamination that there might be will be rapidly diluted out by these air changes. It might need extra time for decontamination of horizontal surfaces, but not from air hygiene. The other issue that often comes up is other discipline wanting to use the orthopedic ultra-clean ventilated theatres. There will be nothing, there's so rapid a turnover air in ultra-clean ventilated theatres that there are going to be no airborne contaminants going from one operating session to the next operating session. It goes against many theatre traditions that there should be no problem with other disciplines using orthopaedic theatres. It used to be common practice to keep ventilation in theatres running at full all the time. This was a luxury from the era of cheap energy. We can no longer do it. Theatres should either be put on a setback status with a far lower ventilation rate, or, preferably, they should be turned off when they're not in use. If you think about the airborne contamination in theatre, it's mainly from people in theatre. When a theatre isn't in use, say overnight, there's nobody in a theatre. There's nothing to generate contamination. So if the air, if the ventilation is turned on, say, 30 minutes before it's first used, then anything that was in the theatre will be diluted out to very, very low levels. If you're going to have this approach, there should be an override linked to either movement sensors or the theatre light. This setback status is normally done on a time basis. If a theatre list overruns, then nobody's going to be looking at the surgeon's panel to see whether the ventilation is on. So there should be an automatic override to ensure that the ventilation doesn't go into setback or off mode when the theatre is still being used. Slide 30, please. Okay, that was operating theatres. You also need specialist ventilation in healthcare for some applications of isolation. Let's deal with protective isolation first. Most protective isolation doesn't need specialist ventilation. It's behavioral. There is a small, normally clearly identifiable group of highly neutropenic patients who are greatly at risk from inhalation of airborne fungal spores. Airborne fungal spores would occur in the outside air. Occasionally they occur from mold inside hospitals, but always and predominantly from outside air. So the strategy for ventilating protective isolation for highly neutropenic patients is to ensure that every lung full of air that they breathe has passed through a HEPA filter. Slide 31, please. The only way of making sure that this happens is to supply a lot more air to their rooms than is extracted. So there's a surplus of air in the room. This surplus of air will leak out through lots of small gaps that it's very difficult to do anything about in the room. If there's a loss of clean air out of those gaps, it means that contaminated air from outside can't come in from those gaps. So this is positive pressure. A lot of people think that protective ventilation is just about positive pressure. I disagree with that. It's mainly about HEPA filtration. The positive pressure makes sure that there's only HEPA filtered air in the room. Positive pressure without HEPA filtration is meaningless. You're just mechanically supplying them with fungal spores from the outside. It's got to have HEPA filtration. The ventilation rate in HEPA filtered positive pressure isolation is not important. You're not trying to do anything. You're just trying to maintain the integrity of the HEPA filter in the rooms. Sometimes, particularly for bone marrow transplant units, the HEPA filters are not in individual branches of the system supplying each room, but centrally in the air handling unit. This means that the whole of the unit is HEPA filtered, the unit being at slight positive pressure to the outside, to the surroundings. This means that the patients aren't incarcerated in their rooms, but can wander out and remain protected through the whole unit. Slide 32, please. Now there's source isolation. Let me take you through a couple of TB outbreaks. The first was written up in the 1990s. Source patient, HIV negative but poorly compliant. Their TB gathered resistance after resistance. They were brought into hospitals and they were put in an isolation room. Unfortunately, the isolation room was under positive pressure, not negative pressure. So what they were coughing up went under the door into the adjacent ward. Unfortunately, the adjacent ward had a high proportion of HIV-positive patients. Six HIV-positive patients and one HIV-positive counsellor who was on the ward acquired the index patient strain. The times were remarkably short, from 33 days to less than one day. So immunodeficiency, in this case HIV, really changed the dynamics of TB transmission. Slide 33, please. There's been a more recent report from Sweden. Again, there were similarities. The index patient was in isolation, but there was a misdiagnosis of pneumocystis when it was really tuberculosis, and they were taken out of isolation. Four patients, some of whom had HIV, and three healthcare workers who didn't have HIV, acquired this patient's strain of TB. And there was a correlation between the amount of exposure and TB acquisition. Slide 34, please. So, airborne isolation. The aim is to prevent uncontrolled escape of pathogens from the room and to dilute pathogens inside the room. Now, in the UK, there are two alternative approaches: negative pressure rooms and positive pressure ventilated lobby, PPVL rooms. These are detailed in this guidance, again, available on the www.gov.uk site. Slide 36, please. This is an illustration of the PPVL room. A lobby, a patient room, and an ensuite bath shower. The lobby only has a very powerful supply. You can see S in a little square there. So that's a very powerful supply. Half of the air supplied to the lobby leaks out through a grill in the door into the corridor, and half of the air goes into the patient room through a pressure release damper, marked number 5 in that diagram. So this puts a barrier between the corridor and the patient room. The air then circulates around the patient room that has no other ventilation, and then goes through a grill in the door to the bathroom where there's a powerful extract. So this dilutes what's in the patient room and extracts it through the patient's bathroom. Now, this is described as a neutral, the patient's bedroom is described as a neutral pressure area. But neutral in this term means just neither intentionally positive nor intentionally negative. It will always be slightly positive or slightly negative. Because it might be slightly positive, an air might travel through gaps from the patient's room into the corridor. The room itself has to be leak tested, and leaks have to be plugged on commissioning and hopefully at regular intervals thereafter. So it's not a room without certain maintenance considerations. Slide 37, please. The alternative, and this is what most of the world uses, and to me seems more straightforward, is a negative pressure room. This is a room with a vast excess of extract over supply. More air is extracted from the room than deliberately supplies, so the deficit between extract and supply has to come in, say, under the door and through lots of gaps in the room. If air is coming in through those gaps, it means the contaminated air generated in the room can't go out. So people in surrounding areas are protected from whatever's generated in the room. It contains it also accomplishes dilution within the room for the safety of staff and visitors. Yes, staff and visitors would use respiratory protection, but you can't guarantee that that's total protection. Personal protective equipment is lowest in the hierarchy of protective measures. Far higher than that are mechanical solutions, such as ventilation. So you need to ensure the room is negative pressure. It doesn't particularly matter what the pressure, what the value of that pressure is, but you're most interested in the fact that it's robust negative pressure. This could be done with an electronic gauge with an alarm, normally that alarms at the nurse's station on the ward. It should always have a delay in with it. Every time you open the door between the patient's room and the corridor, the pressure will go down to zero. This means the alarm would go off. If there's something like a 5-minute delay, then the alarm will only go off when there's a serious defect in the ventilation. It could also be a mechanical gauge, but that needs to be read and recorded regularly. The air change rate has got to be at a medium that's compatible with dilution in the room and patient comfort. It's essential to keep the patient comfortable because this is going to be long-term isolation. You're not going to get the patient's cooperation if they're uncomfortable. So it tends to be round about 10 air changes per hour is compatible with patient comfort and dilution. If it's a room that's for temporary occupation, such as bronchoscopy room, it could have far higher ventilation rates. Slide 38, please. One air change does not result in 100% dilution of what's in a room. New air will come into a room and will displace old air. Once you have quite a lot of units of new air come into a room, perhaps an extra unit of new air will leave a unit of old air behind but displace a unit of new air. So one air change removes 63% of contamination, leaves about 37% of contamination. The next air change will produce the same dilution of what remains. So the chart in front of you shows you, assuming perfect mixing of air, the dilution from 100%, so this is assuming that dispersion has ceased with sequential air changes. With five air changes, you're down to below 1% of what was there originally. So if you're thinking about a bronchoscopy room where there is a TB risk, it seems to be accepted that if you lower the rate to 1% or less of what it was when the patient left, then you have achieved safety. So five air changes. To determine this, you need to know the air change rate for that room. In this example, a bronchoscopy room with 30 air changes per hour will achieve five air changes in 10 minutes, because it's one air change every 2 minutes. So you will get 99% removal after 10 minutes. You don't need a specific air change rate in a bronchoscopy room used for tuberculosis risk patients, but you do need to know the air change rate so that you can calculate the time period that it takes for five air changes. Slide 39, please. What do you do with the extracted air? The most robust solution is to extract it onto the hospital roof with an extraction stack that's at least 3 meters high, so it doesn't extract in anybody's breathing zone, and it then gets exhausted to infinite dilution in the atmosphere. This is the most straightforward approach. Only think about putting it through HEPA filters if you can't achieve this. If you can extract it so that it's in nobody's breathing zone, it's not near ventilation system intakes, and it's not near opening windows, this is a very robust solution. If you do have to filter it, what you're doing is that you're taking infectious particles and deliberately concentrating them on a filter. So when the filter is blocked and it needs to be changed, there need to be safe methods of work so the person who changes it isn't exposed to these concentrated infectious particles. If you do have to have filters, they need to have safe methods of changing them. And slide 40, please. So, that's a rather quick tutorial on the intricacies of specialist ventilation in healthcare. If you're faced with designing or input designing a system, my advice is to go for a solution that's simple and robust. That's the one that's most likely to last. Not just that it's okay on initial commissioning, but it's okay 5, 10, or 15 years down line. If you can't avoid that and you need to install systems that have complexity, there needs to be a monitoring schedule in place. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much indeed, Peter. As usual, you've put over a very complex subject in a very understandable and practical format. Ask a question, if I may. I'm always getting surgeons moaning to me about humidity in the theatre, and I know it can be uncomfortable if the humidity isn't quite correct, but is there any infection implications that you're aware of with regard to humidity in theatres?
No, none at all. The humidity never rises sufficiently to get bacterial or fungal growth. If it's a problem, it's not your problem.
Amazing how many things do end up in the door of infection prevention and control there. Well, thank you very much again, Peter. Can I highlight to everybody the next teleclasses in the series for the year? There will be further UK teleclasses later on in the year. But in the month of May, we have methods to evaluate hand hygiene. There's some chap warbling on from the IPAC Canada conference. And also infection control and long-term care, also from the Canadian meeting. And then come hell or high water, infection control during and after floods, also from Canada. So it's very much a North American flavour to the rest of the teleclasses for the next couple of months. My grateful thanks to Peter for an excellent presentation. My thanks to the patron sponsors of the entire teleclass series of 2014, which is the World Health Organization, the Centre for Research on Environmental Microbiology and Virox Technologies, and as ever, my thanks to Paul Weber at Weber Training for facilitating this most excellent teleclass series. I hope to speak to you again later on in the year when we have further teleclasses for you. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. Goodbye.